From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Tuesday night around 11 p.m. It was election day, election night, and by 11 p.m., the assumption had been that Congresswoman Louise Slaughter would have wrapped up another victory, giving her 30 years in Congress representing Western New York and the greater Rochester area. Instead, with 97% of the votes in the 25th Congressional District counted at that time, the number we were looking at was 13, as in 13 votes separating Mrs. Slaughter and Republican challenger Mark Cassini. 13 votes at that time out of about 170,000 plus, and at that moment, anyone who hadn't voted might have been regretting that decision. Turnout was rather low, and as the numbers went back and forth, it looked too close to call. Well, at the conclusion of election night, Mrs. Slaughter had regained the lead out in front at the time by more than 500 votes. The subsequent rounds of counting, looking at absentee ballots, has pushed her lead to 651 votes out of more than 190,000 cast. The counting continues today, but Slaughter has declared victory. Mark Cassini has asked that we count all of the votes before deciding who won. Regardless of the outcome, Cassini's campaign is a surprise success. Well, perhaps not a surprise to him, but a surprise to most of us. And he joins us in studio now for the hour. Mark Cassini, thank you for being here.
Evan, thank you for having me. It seems like yesterday you first interviewed me. I think it was back in May that you gave me an opportunity to speak to your listeners, and I'm grateful for that. So thank you, and happy Veterans Day to our veterans. We owe you a debt we cannot repay, so thank you.
I echo that. In fact, happy Veterans Day to my dad and all the many veterans out there listening to this program. You came from an event as well, Mark?
Yes, we had a Veterans Day event at the town of Gates, very well attended. It was a wonderful service, very touching. We had a 100-year-old veteran who is the oldest surviving Pearl Harbor veteran in Monroe County. It was incredible. He was just a wonderful man to talk to, great history, very brave man, and we're so grateful for his service and all our veterans' service.
We've indicated to Congresswoman Slaughter that we look forward to having her back on this program soon, and we expect that will be very soon. It's an open invitation, and certainly you understand why, when you look at 651 votes, that it's a very tight race, but at the same time, that's still a large number for you to overcome. Give us a sense of where things stand, when it could be wrapped up, how many outstanding votes there are, the very latest that you've been told, Mark.
There's approximately 3,500 votes we anticipate will be counted. Most of them, almost all of them, will be tomorrow. There's still a few military ballots that may come in. The need for the Cassini campaign to win is a 60-40 split. Some would say that's not possible statistically. I will tell you that it depends on where those ballots are from. If they're from the west side of the district, it is very possible. We were very strong on the west side of the district. In some cases on the west side, we won almost 2-1. So it all depends on where they're from, and we just don't know at this point, and we'll find out tomorrow.
Are you disappointed that the number hasn't narrowed and, in fact, has gotten larger against you, though, since election night?
No, I'm not. I'm very pleased with the way things have turned out, and we have a chance a week after the election's over to still possibly win this race. So I'm nothing but pleased.
When it comes to the timing tomorrow, are you going to be there? Mark, of course, the Gatestown supervisor, are you going to be down there? What's the sort of the time frame and the plan for tomorrow?
Well, I still have a job at Gatestown Hall, and I have a couple meetings planned. I'll be working and doing productive things for the taxpayer. And I'll hear from the party chairman, Bill Rylick, who will be working on the count with his team. And I'll get updates throughout the day. They believe it'll take about 5 hours, maybe a little more, maybe a little less.
Okay, and starting when?
They didn't give me a time frame when the count would start, but they said it would take about 5 hours once the count began.
I feel, again, I said this on election night on the air. I feel like, you know, you and I and Mrs. Slaughter could get this done in an hour if we set about it, but everybody's impatient. I guess it's good to be, it's important to be patient for one more day.
Right. You know, we always, Republicans always get accused of voter suppression. This is a case where let's let all the votes count. You know, certainly we want all the votes to be counted.
We're talking to Mark Cassini. If you want to join the program, it's toll-free. The number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, right here in Rochester. You can also join the program, comment online or on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. And we're happy to link you up and give you a chance to talk to someone who might be the next congressperson from this district. But if you are not, you and I spoke last week, and you said this certainly solidifies or kind of creates a viability for 2 years from now. Correct. Why 2 years from now? In a year, there's a county executive election, and a lot of people have said to me quietly in the last week, doesn't this make you viable as a Republican in the county election next year?
Well, I think there are a lot of candidates that could do a good job as county executive. My job right now is a Gatestown supervisor, unless I'm elected to Congress. And if I'm not, my goal has always been to go to Congress, serve, and make some of the changes that I think we can make to better this district and help the people of this district. But I got to tell you, we've had so much fun. I truly, if people did not get that on election night or over the last couple of days, we've had so much fun with this campaign. It was such an oddity. We had a group of family members and friends, and even some of my family members and friends had doubted we could really do this race, but it was us. It was us sitting around our campaign headquarters, which was my home. And it was around the kitchen table. And there were days we'd look at each other and throw some money in the middle of the table to try to put together literature or ads. And even some of my friends had doubted that this was possible. But it was just tremendous. It was a lot of fun. And on election night, I had my children had come in from all over, and we were celebrating my daughter's passing the bar exam, and it was our anniversary the next day. So we literally, regardless of the results, we had fun. We stayed up till 5 in the morning, joking, laughing, teasing as family members do, and literally just had a ball. It'll be a memory that we have forever. So I'm so grateful for that.
Okay. Well, as much fun as you had, you also, I'm guessing, didn't get this kind of party support that Maggie Brooks got 2 years ago. And so I think there's a couple of interesting questions that come out of this, Mark. Number one, there's the question of, if you had more support, would it have even helped you? You know, is the notion of more mailers, more negative ads, more money investing actually a detriment? And so let me start there. Do you wish you had had more party support, and were you disappointed in your party?
Nationally, the party was not interested in the race. There's no question about it. They just didn't care. I think one of the issues was the fact that I had indicated to them early on that I wanted to run my own race, and I'd appreciate any help they could offer, but it's going to be my race, and it's going to be my ideas, and it's going to be about our community, and it's not going to be the traditional national campaign. So that may have turned them off.
What does that mean? What's a traditional national campaign?
Well, I think the traditional campaign is a hard-hitting, negative, criticize the opponent a type of campaign, and they have been successful. I didn't want to do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, my community is very important to me. I didn't want to go to the grocery store and have to look at my neighbor in the eye and say, I'm sorry I ran those kind of ads. I didn't want to be embarrassed. I didn't want to hold my head down. I wanted to be able to hold my head up and be proud of the type of campaign we ran, that we were positive, that we were favorable, that we talked about what we were going to do instead of, how bad my opponent's ideas are. And that's the type of campaign that we ran. We didn't want to run the traditional Washington campaign, which is, the slamming the other person and criticizing the other person. And quite frankly, I like Mrs. Slaughter. And I've told her this publicly and privately. I don't dislike her. I like her as a person. I think she's done some good things as a congresswoman. This wasn't a case where there was any animosity at all. Hopefully that came through in the campaign. And I was very respectful to her throughout, even the debates. I understand where she's coming from. My family are all progressive, so I'm from a family of progressives. So I get it. I understand. These are good people. They have certain ideas and certain ways they think to make America better. On some things, I agree with them. On some things, I disagree. And it was the same thing with Mrs. Slaughter. I think that there are things we just weren't going to agree on, and there were other things I did agree with.
Did you have family members who voted for her?
No. They crossed the line.
They
crossed the line for bro.
the rare occasion to vote for a Republican?
Yes. The only time my sister did. She's a big, we have a little bit of a riff in the family. My brother Carl is a huge Barack Obama supporter, and my sister Vicky is a huge Hillary Clinton supporter. Now, both of those individuals came together to vote for me, but it's been some very interesting debates between the two when the president was running against Hillary Clinton for the nomination. So anyways,
The bottom line is they at least voted for you. That must make for some interesting conversation.
It was very interesting.
But if you had more money, if the National Party had supported you more, would the race have looked different? Could you, let me ask this a different way. You're the candidate. Because to some degree, when we see these negative ads or mailers or really sort of cartoonish and ugly stuff, often the candidate will say, well, look, that's not me. Somebody else is doing it. How much did you feel that if more money came in, then the race would have gone that way? Or could you have prevented it from going that way?
I made it clear that there would be no strings attached. There were no promises that I made to anyone. I told them if they want to write a check, if they want to help out financially. I am a Republican. I do support the Republican principles, but the race is going to be me. It's going to be my personality, what my priorities are, and that's the way it is. So to answer your question, I wouldn't have allowed it to go any other direction other than what I felt was important to the district. There were local issues and local concerns that I wanted to discuss, and I didn't want to get into the back and forth that you see in some of the uglier campaigns.
Is there lack of participation? The difference, though, if you lose by a few hundred votes, could they have put you over the top with more interest and investment?
I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not sure what would have happened if they would have offered up more money. Would we have run more ads? Yes. Would they have been the similar type of ads that we ran? Yes. Would we have done some mailers? Yes. We would have gotten into more details on issues. Again, they would have been things that I was prioritizing and I thought were concerns for the district. They wouldn't have been negative. Would it have helped? I'm sure it would have helped, but I'm not going to cry over spilt milk.
Okay. We're talking to Mark Cassini. We're going to get to the phones. Don and others, if you're waiting, we're going to get to you in a moment as we talk to Mark Cassini this hour. I think what I'm trying to pin down is if you think this actually might shift the model for what works. And I say that because you look at 2 years ago. Maggie Brooks got essentially blown out by Louise Slaughter in a high-profile race. Two very well-known people, well-regarded within their own parties, and a lot of money was spent on that race. I assume a lot more money spent on that race than in the race between you and Mrs. Slaughter, yes?
Yeah, the $150,000 that I was able to raise and spend was just a drop in the bucket.
How much did Maggie Brooks raise and spend? Do you know?
Oh, $1.5 million, approximately.
So roughly 10 times.
Yes.
And she loses well into the double digits, and if you lose, it'll be a fraction of a point.
I think that there are a number of factors that played into this. One is the midterm elections, as you know and as your listeners know. Midterm elections are usually lower voter turnout, and that lower voter turnout will favor the party who does not have the president in the White House. In this case, the Republican Party did not have the president in the White House, and you know that typically favors you know the party out of power, so to speak. So we knew that low voter turnout, midterm election, party out of power gets, you know, gets a little bit of a bump. There was frustration with gridlock. Mrs. Brooks and Mrs. Slaughter ran at a time when there was a huge turnout for the president, great support for President Barack Obama. That brought out a lot of votes, much more voter turnout. But we knew that when we were going into this race. We knew this was going to be a lower voter turnout race. And so part of the strategy was to stay under the radar and just, you know, go out and do a very grassroots-oriented campaign, knowing that we didn't have a lot of money and also knowing that this was a midterm-style election with a low voter turnout. And you could have an impact with a grassroots campaign with a much lower voter turnout versus a high turnout year like a presidential year.
About 191,000 votes cast this time around.
Yeah, that's about right.
Versus about 320,000 2 years ago.
Correct.
Okay, and that's a difference of between 35% and 40%. We're
right.
Talking about a huge change. We haven't seen this small of a turnout in decades in the district. And so does that, by the way, Mark, does that counter the notion? We've been talking about a Republican wave. Does that countered the notion that it was a Republican wave, and is the truth that it was just a lack of Democratic turnout as opposed to a Republican wave?
I think there's some truth to that. I think that Democrats are not motivated to come out this time around. I think there was some frustration. Malaise is what I kept saying in our war room. The war room was our kitchen table at my house on Buffalo Road. My wife and I would talk about that. And I think to some degree that's probably a very good observation on your part. Yes.
Let me get to our first phone call. This is Don in Rochester. Go ahead, Don. You're on with Mark Cassini.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Cassini, you just described yourself as a progressive. But we have to look at the policy.
A progressive. He described himself as a Republican who believes in Republican principles. We are going to talk more about that in some detail as we go forward. But
Don, I will say my family are all progressives. They call themselves.
You described yourself that way just a few minutes ago. But whether or not, if you are a progressive, we have to take a look at your National Republican Party. This morning's New York Times had an article about how when Mitch McConnell becomes Senate Majority Leader, he's going to do everything in his power to not only pass the Keystone XL pipeline, but he's going to do his best to dismantle EPA programs and underfund the EPA. Your party wants to turn this country back 100 years to a time when there was no EPA, there was no Great Society programs, there were no New Deal programs, unions were weak, minimum wage didn't exist, maximum hours didn't exist. That is the trajectory of the Republican Party, is to turn this country back to that. Whether you're a progressive or not makes no difference. What the people need to do is what they did in the 1930s to push FDR. We need to be out in the street. We need to do what we did in the 60s, is to be out in the street and demand that things like the Great Society programs be passed. The only thing that's going to stop you and the Democrats, they're the same way too, they're a lot more subtle about it, but the only thing that's going to stop this trajectory is that people get out in the streets and fight back.
Don, thanks for the call. And the one thing that Mark and I have already established is that certainly if Democrats want to win future elections, they cannot suffer the low turnout they had last Tuesday. Mark agrees with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about his concern is that, let's say you're elected to Congress, and Don's already forcing the conversation down. What happens if Mark wins? And Mark can still win. He'd need to get about 60% of the outstanding ballots, roughly, they're going to finish that count tomorrow. So we'll find out. But he talked about Keystone Pipeline. Keystone Pipeline?
Oh, I support energy exploration and expansion. Absolutely. It's a good thing for jobs. It's a good thing to reduce our energy costs and make us competitive as a manufacturing country again. So yeah, I support that. But I'm not somebody that says, let's throw away the EPA, let's throw away the environmental regs. No, absolutely. We have to be good stewards of our environment. There's no question about that. I would not support the elimination of the EPA. So that should not be a concern. I think the tone on both sides, I think the president set a poor tone, and I think our congressional leaders set a poor tone battling over some of the issues that they're battling over right now. One of which is that I talked about this during the campaign, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, whether you agree with it or whether you don't agree with it, cannot be repealed. I can't stress this enough. It is a waste of time to discuss this. It can't be done. There are not enough votes in Congress under any scenario, at least for the next 2+ years, to repeal this law. It is not physically possible. So we should focus
it be? Let's say you had the executive. Let's say 2 years from now you're a member of Congress, you get reelected, and you win the White House. Should it be repealed?
There are parts of it I don't think should be repealed. Absolutely not. I think the fact that we have a law that allows the elimination of pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, I love the exchanges. Those things should be kept intact. But I would like to see it changed to allow competition across state lines, for instance. I think that would be great. It would help drive down the prices. I think we have to change, and the Supreme Court may be looking at this, how the subsidies work. Yes, we want to help people to get insurance, but the subsidies are so rich right now that they're actually hurting Medicare. The cuts that are coming from Medicare are supporting the subsidies, and those have to be reduced. The subsidies, according to the CBO, will actually reduce the workforce by 2.5 million people because they're that rich. So there are a number of things that could be used in the Affordable Care Act, but there are a number of things that have to be changed. You know, to say repeal, I don't think we'll ever repeal a complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I think that ship has sailed, and I think we just have to take the good parts of the law and make them better.
Is it working better a year and a month after the disastrous rollout of the website? Is it working better than you expected it to?
Parts of it are, parts of it aren't. I don't mean to be wishy-washy, but that's true. Again, I looked at what happened to our seniors in this area. They got raked over the coals. The 19,000 seniors have lost their Medicare Advantage plans. That's not a good thing. That is not working the way it was supposed to work. We were told that if you were a senior, you wouldn't have to worry about losing your plan. You could keep your doctor if you liked your doctor, and you'd see a reduction in your costs of an average of $2,500 per family per year. In the case of Medicare Advantage, for instance, and to be specific, seniors were seeing an average increase, if you look at MVP, of 44.6%. It's not working the way it's supposed to work. So there are parts of it that have helped people that couldn't get insurance before that are getting insurance. I have a sister who is now getting insurance that was struggling with her insurance payments before. And it's helped some people, but it's also hurt some people. There's some things we really need to change in the law.
You would be joining a party that only strengthened its control of the House of Representatives and is now gained control of the Senate. And I still don't know, other than repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which, again, you've talked about it being unrealistic, and I think some party leaders acknowledge that's unrealistic. I still don't fully know what the Republican Party on the national level stands for in health care, as opposed to I know what they don't like, but I don't know what your party really wants to do.
Well, I'm frustrated that this has become the priority. The priority, and I can tell you after going to 12,000 homes, what people are worried about, they're worried about their kids getting jobs. They're worried about keeping their jobs. In fact, the Voice of the Voter did a poll on how many people are concerned about having a job tomorrow, and it was almost 3/4 of the people. That's what we need to focus on right now. The economy is not working the way it's supposed to. People are still struggling. They're making less than they did several years ago. People are worried about losing their jobs. We have to take that on, and we have to fix this economy, and we can do it. And actually, the federal government can make some changes to help grow this economy, but that should be the focus. And that's why I was a little disappointed. We're talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act. Well, that shouldn't be the number one priority. The economy needs to be the number one priority, and I assure you that's what people are worried about here.
But when it comes to health care, isn't that a little bit of a dodge? I mean, I still don't know. What is it in health care that you and the party want instead? And again, I not because you want to repeal all of Obamacare, but what has to change? What would be put in place to make healthcare more affordable, better quality, et cetera?
As I said, to open these exchanges up nationally would make a huge difference. I know people say that's a talking point. It isn't. I've talked about this before. We have done this locally. The town supervisors got together. We threw all our insurance contracts into a pool. We bid this out. We gave a spec to the insurance companies, and we said lowest price that meets our specification gets these contracts, and there were thousands of contracts. And they came back, and they gave us a tremendous price, much lower than we had to face without the bidding of these contracts. So in the case of the town of Gates, we ended up saving over 3 years, $1.6 million. $1.6 million for a little town like Gates. This is an opportunity, really, to reduce costs. And then it forces the insurance companies to fight for market share, find better ways to deliver services, to work with which is really the root cause, the providers, the healthcare providers themselves, the doctors, the hospitals, et cetera, to become more efficient. You cannot do that without the insurance companies getting involved and finding a way to make the process and make the delivery of these services more efficient. And that's the way to do it. Get them to compete with one another for market share, and you'll see the prices drop.
Sometime in the last 5 minutes, Mark Cassini said something, and all of a sudden, every one of our phone lines is filled. So, I'd like to get to in fact, if you're waiting to talk to Mark Cassini, after the break, we're going to get right through your phone calls and have a chance to do that. And I know a lot of our listeners have been looking forward to that, and we appreciate Mark being here and being able to take some of those calls. Before we do that, though, one other specific issue here when it comes to healthcare. When we last talked, it was right around the time that we saw those terrible Isla Vista killings on the West Coast. And, we talked about the fact that Richard Martinez, the father of one of the victims, was blaming the NRA and talking about the need for new restrictive gun policy. And your response was that you certainly felt for a father of a victim, but what you want to see the emphasis is on better treatment of mental illness. Now I'm looking at the Affordable Care Act, which increases coverage for care of mental illness in a lot of ways. And if you oppose a lot of parts of the Affordable Care Act, does that sort of conflict with the notion that when it comes to issues surrounding mental illness and firearms, do those things conflict for you?
No, here's the deal. We can break down each and every one of the elements, and that would be eight shows, and there would be six people awake. But the
well, you know, I think we get a little wonky. That's okay.
But the bottom line is that there are certain parts of this law that work well.
Mental health care being one of them?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, and as I said, I've seen family members that have benefited from this law. So I'm not ready to throw, you know, everything out. I think, though, we need to take a step back and revamp this. This was rushed so quickly to get passed, and I get it. You know, the bottom line was that there were many that felt unless they rushed to get this passed, nothing would be done. But unfortunately, now we have a number of aspects of the law that are just not working the way they were intended to work and need to be fixed. I'm not saying throw out the aspects of the law that work well, but the ones that don't, we need to revamp them.
Okay, and before the break in the calls, the last question from the host for now is, let me just make sure that we square this up. Is there a chance that you will run for county executive next year if you don't get the votes to win this election tomorrow?
That's not on my radar, no. The answer is no.
Could the party come to you and say, you're the guy?
They could come to me, and they could say a lot, but the answer is no.
You would not even consider?
I don't want to never say never, but right now that's not a consideration for me. I like what I'm doing at the town. It's local government. I'm fixing potholes and drainage problems, and I get to work with people on a daily basis that I've called neighbor and friend for many years, and I like that. The county executive's position is a much, much larger job that would take me away from that. I would prefer doing what I'm doing right now. I certainly would like to be in Congress. That would be my ultimate goal and my ultimate path.
So you'll run again in 2 years if you don't get the votes to win tomorrow?
You can count on it.
Okay, so that at least draws one line in the sand. Then tell me, is it at least fair?
Evan, why are you making me draw these lines in
the sand?
Well,
you know, let's wait till tomorrow. That's fair. But let me at least ask, has the party talked to you privately since last Tuesday and said, hey, if this doesn't work out this time, let's think about county executive? Have people come to you and said, this has to be considered?
There have been members of the party that have asked me, not any of the leaders, so to speak. I wouldn't share anyways what is told to me in private. But I will just, without being evasive, I'll say that no leader has come to me and asked me that.
How is your relationship with the local party?
Good, fine.
Okay. And last question then, be the analyst. If it's not you, who is the Republican on the ballot for county executive next year?
That's better asked of the chairman of the party, Bill Reilich. I will be evasive there.
See, he's been direct on some things and indirect on others. Mark Cassini is our guest for the hour. We're going to take a short break. And if you're just joining us again, the update is that tomorrow the Board of Elections will finish the counting of the ballots. Mark saying that they think roughly 3,500 still to count. He needs to win about 60% of those to have a chance to overtake Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Mrs. Slaughter's declared victory, but Mr. Cassini says there's been 191,000 votes counted. Let's get the last few thousand counted before we finish this thing off. It's been a remarkably close race all throughout. That we all admitted in the media. We were surprised, and Mark said the only one who wasn't surprised was him. And that may be true, but here we are, and that's what the beauty of elections is, I guess. Mark came to us a week before the election and said, you're going to be surprised, and some people rolled their eyes, Mark.
Well, after, you know, this wasn't any piece of genius. We did not do any polling. I want to make it clear. We didn't do any polling whatsoever. Some people said they had snap polls, but I don't believe those. Those are basically just phone calls to 50 people and who knows. Yeah. But I knew after talking to 12,000, and not everybody was home, going to 12,000 homes, talking to several thousand families, that even in districts that were strong for Mrs. Slaughter, that people were willing to give us a chance. Knowing that, and having, you know, basically a split as I was going around from home to home, I said, this is going to be very close. I had enough experience in campaigning to know what a close race feels like. I know that sounds a little odd, but that's true. And so I had a pretty good idea this was going to be fairly close from talking to families as I went door to door.
All right, your questions next for Mark Cassini as we continue on Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we're marking 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Who takes the credit, but who really deserves the credit? And what has the impact been in the quarter century since the wall came down? We talked to a local professor who not only teaches the subject, but has been there many times himself. His observations, the stories he has seen over the years, all next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Glad to have Gatestown Supervisor Mark Cassini, the Republican who's still hoping to unseat Democrat Louise Slaughter when they finish counting the ballots tomorrow. And sometime tomorrow, we should get word on that. You expect to get word? I assume the moment it's done, they'll at least let you know.
I would hope, yes. Yeah, that we should have word.
I guess what I'm asking is, will you know a day before we will, or will you know minutes before we will?
I may know minutes after you know,
okay.
But hopefully I'll know minutes before you know. But we'll know sometime tomorrow. This has been such a great experience. I'm so pleased with the way this has gone. And I said at election night, we had a lot of people that we met at the doors, and a lot of them didn't support me, but almost all were gracious and kind. And I obviously, Evan, if somebody's coming to your house while you're eating dinner or you're doing the yard, you're not exactly patient, you know, especially if it's a politician saying, "Hi, I'm Mark Cassini. I'm running for Congress. I just wanted to meet you and say hello and give you a chance to ask me a question or two." But other than being bitten once by a dog in Irondequoit, everything was cool. People were really nice, and I appreciate that, and I'm grateful. And again, to those that didn't support me and didn't vote for me, I do appreciate it. I really, truly appreciate your kindness, so thank you.
Let's get to the phones, and this is Andrew in Irondequoit. Andrew, you're on with Mark Cassini.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hey, Mark, congratulations on running such a fine campaign.
I'm grateful. Thank you.
And I think it's great that I think you're the perfect guy for the job, because being a town supervisor and a popular one in a state like this, of course, I think you could bring valuable insight to the Congress down there, you know, how things get done.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. In fact, there'll be a story tonight. I'm not supposed to say it, I think, on WXXI, but Channel 10 is, I already did. Channel 10 is doing a story on flood insurance, and that's a national issue, but it affects people locally in this community, in your community, and all the communities around the 25th Congressional District. But I have such insight, not because I'm a brilliant man, but because I've had to deal with this as a town supervisor, and I've had to work with residents who are being impacted by this in their lives, the ability for them to afford their homes, et cetera, and I have some ideas on how to address it and fix it. But, you know, being a town supervisor, you get to see, you know, everything that's impacting people at the very lowest level of government, you know, right in the neighborhood. So that you're right. That's a great piece of experience to have going to Congress.
One more thing. Could you please tell the members of Congress, both the Congress and the Senate, enough already? You've got enough money down there. I go to D.C. all the time, and the place is really literally swimming in money. It's just crazy how much money is down there.
Well, we're struggling up here in upstate New York, but it's a boomtown down in Washington, D.C.
If people knew how much money is floating around down there, they'd be like, why am I paying so much in taxes? They've got enough already.
Yeah.
They just need to manage it better, and a guy like you can help them do that.
Well, I appreciate that.
Andrew,
thanks
for the call. Appreciate that. This is Mike in Rochester. You're on with Mark Cassini. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, hi. First of all, I'd like to just say something that it never ceases to amaze me when political people get on the air, how they pander to senior citizens. And I happen to be a senior citizen. And, yes, my advantage rates have gone up, but they've gone up from $27 to $49 a month. I have a wife who's not on Medicare, and her plan, she's going to have to pay $480 a month for a high deductible plan. So I don't like it when you pander to senior citizens when I am getting outrageously cheap rates compared to what my kids have to pay and what my wife has to pay, and that's where the emphasis should be. Number one, and number two. Sir, if you were to somehow upset Ms. Slaughter and went to Washington, would you support congressional members going on high deductible insurance plans rather than having the Cadillac policies that they presently have now? Would you support going to a high deductible plan?
Absolutely.
Let me explain something to you, Mike, if I could. In legislation?
Let me explain something, if I could.
Go ahead, Mark.
I've been very fortunate in the private sector. I did very well. I worked for a great company. But I left a salary, which, you know, I'm not going to make in Washington. I did it. My kids were grown. I did it for the right reasons. I did it because I wanted to serve, not because I want to get rich. If I wanted to get rich, I'd stay in the private sector. Trust me. In fact, without getting into too much, my former boss called me when the election results were coming in. He says, well, are you coming back to work for me or not? But in any event, to your point, the Congress should be subject to the same rules as the people they serve, and they should be subject to the same benefits as the people they serve. And I have absolutely no issue with that. I'm not there to make money. I'm not there to climb the ladder. I've already committed to the fact that I would serve no more than 8 years, period, end of story, because there's other things I want to do with my life.
Now, the question I have for you, that I wish people would, I mean, senior citizens are getting a huge subsidy for their Medicare Advantage plans, and everybody knows that, but nobody is willing to talk that because they might offend people like me, and then I won't vote for them. But I am getting an outrageously cheap rate, and yet I have to hear outrageous rates for seniors. What about the working? Well, you're under 65. You probably know what it costs to get insurance in the other than Medicare Advantage. But yet, I continually hear about the poor senior citizen. Well, what about the poor working families that have to pay a lot of money for their health insurance? And it's only getting worse.
Well, let me, on Medicare specifically, we can talk about Medicare Advantage. There are people that are being hurt by this. We had a couple of cases, and I know for this for a fact because I know the people, where they're paying $1,500 more a year. That may not seem like a lot for you, but for some people who don't have the money, that's a difficult thing to swallow. But more to the point, Part A, which is the hospitalization, which is zero premium, I'm going to give you a scoop here that isn't out there in the public right now. But Part A has been cut by $260 billion over the next 10 years. That's from the CBO. That's not from me. And we're hearing now from the bean counters in Washington, and I did talk to Washington, and I talked to some of their finance people. There's a discussion on whether they're going to either have to cut, and this is your insurance companies, you can talk to your people at the insurance company, your reps there, and they can tell you the same thing. They're talking about whether they're going to cut services for Part A or whether they're going to raise premiums for Part A. So Medicare, believe it or not, is under attack, and it is going to struggle in the next couple of years. You're going to start seeing more and more increases. You're going to start seeing increases which are well beyond the CPI, and people are going to be affected by it, and I'm not ashamed to bring that issue to light.
Dave on Twitter has an issue with the way you're portraying the ACA. He says the ACA is an atomic unit. There's an interrelationship of subsidies, lower income workers, exchanges. The only feasible replacement is Medicare for everyone. These are naive views from Mark on the ACA and a fundamental misunderstanding of subsidies. Says that, again, you can't just pick parts of it out because of the interrelationship.
Right. I'm going based on the numbers provided by the CBO. I'm a bean counter. That's what I do. And I will tell you that there's over $1.1 trillion worth of subsidies over the next 10 years. And those subsidies are so rich that the CBO has predicted a loss of a workforce of about 2.5 million people. Without getting too wonky, I will just tell you that what that will do, it will impact not only the seniors, or not only the people trying to buy insurance on the exchange, but it'll impact the revenues to the federal budget. Payroll taxes and income taxes that come from people working, that 2.5 million people, will be taken out of the system. So there's a big double whammy that goes along with these subsidies and having people drop out of the workforce. So you're right, there is an interrelationship. And, you know, everybody, and these aren't people that are retirement age. These are people that are just dropping out of the workforce because they don't have to buy insurance anymore, and that was the thing holding them back. But everybody should contribute in society. Everybody should work. And part of the system means that if you're working, you're paying payroll tax, you're paying income tax, and you're helping fund, the system, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. So taking those people out of the system actually hurts the revenues.
Before I get back to the phones, I want to revisit something that you said in this program back in May when you were here before. You talked about the fact that U.S. companies face the highest official corporate tax rate in the world.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, since then, we see people like Tom Coburn, a Republican, and others coming out and saying that, well, you know, yes, U.S. companies face the highest official corporate tax rate in the world, but the big companies rarely pay it. And that the criticism is that the Marcosinis of the world are pointing to the highest rate as opposed to effectively what they're paying, which tends to
be a lot less. Tom Coburn referred to me.
He didn't say
it's very cool.
let me read. He says there's a big difference between the rate set out by law and the cash that's actually collected. Quote, large profitable U.S. corporations paid an average effective federal tax rate of only 12.6% in 2010. That is according to the Government Accountability Office last summer. The federal corporate tax rate stands at 35%, goes to 39.2% when state rates are taken into account. But thanks to tax credits, exemptions, offshore tax havens, et cetera, that Carl Levin, a Democrat from Michigan, Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, looked at, the effective rate is a lot lower. And here's the last quote from Coburn. Quote, an individual's or corporation's tax rate should not be dependent on their ability to hire a tax lobbyist. It's especially wrong to ask families who are struggling to make ends meet subsidize special breaks for corporations. That's a Republican saying that.
Right.
So if he heard you say, well, corporations are getting killed on taxes, someone from your own party may say, you've got it wrong, that they've got a pretty good deal here.
Well, to Tom, I am a businessman and I work in the business world. So I deal with this. I did until I took the town supervisor's job. I deal with this on a practical basis. Let's take a step back. We do have the world's highest business taxes. But specifically, when you start talking about companies like GE that find a way to take advantage of loopholes, that's not the majority of the companies, and that's not the majority of the workforce. The majority of the workforce doesn't have the opportunity to take those advantages. And, you know, we're being very disingenuous if we don't recognize that it's the small company that's driving growth. That's where the majority of growth comes from. And those are the people that are getting hammered by this. And trust me, they are getting hammered. They cannot compete. We talk about Burger King, for instance. The guy that championed tax fairness is who? Warren Buffett. And his company is Berkshire Hathaway. Now, here's a guy that says, you know, the tax system in this country is so unfair, my secretary pays a higher rate than I do. Yet it was his company, Berkshire Hathaway, that saw the problem with having the highest business taxes in the world. And he led Burger King out of the United States into Canada because the tax rate was just too high. Now, some would come back and say afterwards they did the little spin doctoring. Well, that wasn't the reason. We're trying to open up new markets. No, that's not the reason. It was taxes. And so the fact that the majority of the companies in the United States that create the job growth, that drive the economy, are small companies that don't have the ability to take that advantage is not ignoring the fact that it's hurting them. It is hurting them, and it's hurting the economy. Now, I agree with the president, and I said this on the campaign trail, and I said this in the debate. We should close the loopholes for the big guys like GE who take advantage of these corporate loopholes and don't pay the full corporate tax rate. I am 100% on board with that. I agree with the president. Close the loopholes. But anybody that says, and God bless Tom, I don't know what he did for a living. You know, I'm a finance
doctor,
guy.
Doctor, isn't he, Tom Coburn?
Yeah, well, that's not a businessman. That's a doctor. God bless him, though. You know, I can tell you that the companies, and you can talk to companies right here in the area that are getting hurt by that in a big way.
But your party doesn't necessarily agree with what you're saying.
On closing the loopholes?
On the big companies, do they?
Probably not, but that's, you know, I've said that from day one. On the companies that are not paying, you know, the actual rate, they should close the loopholes.
Let's go as fast as we can because every line's filled and we only have about 8 minutes left. Lisa, go ahead with Marcosini.
Oh, hi. I have a question again about voter turnout. And in particular, I have a lot of concern about young people who are not voting. Our culture seems to really focus a lot on celebrities. And our young people tune into a political race, I think, when they sense that there's some kind of big celebrity involved. And I think that's, to some degree, why Obama was so successful, because he had such a great campaign. He was a very winning candidate as a person, which kind of gave him a sort of celebrity status. But when you get down to it, I think a lot of young people, well, to be honest, I think they just don't really know what the issues are, much less what candidates really stand for. And when they get to reach the voting age and they have to go to the voting booth, they're not really sure who to vote for unless it's been somebody that they've heard a lot about. At the same time...
Well, if they're in doubt, they should vote for me.
At the same time, campaign ads on TV are just a turnoff. And I think that it's not helping, I think, engage people, especially young people, who are just deciding really not to vote.
Yeah, Lisa, let me...
I have two high school age children who've recently reached the age of voting. And in this past election, even though we're politically active, my husband and I, and, you know, fairly, you know, educated on the issues, and we try to keep NPR on, and, you know, there's newspapers laying around, and we watch the news, and we try to talk about the issues, there still seems to be this, what do the parties stand for? What do they really mean? What do they want to do? And when our campaigning is so negative and just shooting people down and trying to distort the issues to sort of persuade people to go with one, and I appreciate very much that you ran your own independent campaign, which is why I think your input here in my question is valuable. What can we do to try to change the culture in this country to make voting a civic duty, responsibility, privilege that it is when other people around the world are dying, when our soldiers are dying to protect other people's right to vote?
All right, Lisa,
we cannot get people out.
I've got to jump in and give Mark a chance because I know other callers want to jump in. Go ahead, Mark.
It's very difficult. I think part of the problem is that you know, campaigns have been run in such a negative fashion that people get turned off by it, and they just say that's enough, and they turn off completely to politics. And part of it is because a lot of times people, when they run for office, they make promises, and then they don't fulfill those promises, and they're pulled away by their political parties to do things that they said they wouldn't do. I don't mean to oversimplify this, although truths tend to be simple. I think one of the things to change the climate of politics is to implement term limits. It takes away a lot of power from you know, political parties and leaders, and it really empowers the representatives in a way that our founders had envisioned, and I think that would be very helpful.
Campaign finance reform, yes or no?
I haven't decided yet on that, to be honest. I don't mean to be evasive on that one. I haven't decided yet on that one. I don't like the idea of taxpayers having to fund it, but one of the problems is that there's so much money in politics. It's disturbing, the amount of money that's coming in from people outside the district, people you don't know, unnamed, no-faced sources that are just throwing dollars in to influence a race. It's not good.
All right, let's get Herman in Brighton. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I happened to turn on the radio when I was driving my car, and I happened to hear the tail end of your statement on this station before the election, and I heard you say something which was also touched on in today's discussion, that by itself would have eliminated any chance of my voting for you. And that is, I heard you say Medicare funding must be restored, implying that Medicare had been cut. Right. And it sounds like the widely used Republican talking point that is designed to create the impression that money has been taken out of Medicare, and therefore it would be less financially stable, or that benefits had been cut, and scare seniors into voting Republican. And if you were to look at the Ryan plan, you would see how Medicare would be gutted if the Republicans had their way. So. What you, of course, failed to mention, and Republicans failed to mention, is that the CBO has calculated that the Affordable Care Act extends the financial stability of the Medicare Trust Fund by 8 years. Another thing that is that the Affordable Care Act did is it's closing the donut hole and saving seniors thousands of dollars.
All right, Herman, only because I've only got 45 seconds for Mark to respond. Go ahead, Mark.
The way I looked at this, in fact, this is based off of data provided by the CBO in July of 2012 to the Congress, in which they indicate that, indeed, there is $716 billion being cut out of Medicare. That money is being used to fund the subsidies along with the taxes. And, you know, for instance, the excise tax, which is coming up, which is going to be devastating, which, again, I don't want to get too wonky into all this, but that's right from the CBO. That's not something, that's not a number I came up with. That's a number the CBO came up with. And absolutely, there is reductions in Medicare. Are there some savings being garnered in Medicare from some of the changes? Yes. But in total, it's a $716 billion cut. And, you know, not that I don't mean to be argumentative, but I have to go based on the numbers.
All right. For our listeners who couldn't get through this hour, and I would love to touch on that point and much more in the future with Mark. You can see the phones were lit up all hour. Mark Cassini is still hoping that tomorrow, sometime perhaps in the afternoon, we get word on the final count in his race against Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Mrs. Slaughter's declared victory, but they're still counting about 3,500 votes tomorrow. He needs to close 651 votes. That's about a 60-40 split. He says he thinks he can do it. We're going to find out tomorrow. And either way, I'm sure we will talk to you soon, Mark.
Sure. I'm grateful to have you have me on. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time. And I'm sure we'll see much more of the Gatestown Supervisor. Thank you for your participation, your phone calls. Short break, talking 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Next hour. Stay with us.